The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's nice to be here and see all of you. Is the sound okay? You hear the... Okay, great. So I'll start this morning with a proposal. And it's something that can be verified with mindfulness. And that is that the human mind has a lot of desires. So what I'm calling desire here is quite broad. Let's say that it refers to any kind of wanting, whether gross or subtle. So, you know, we have a desire for food when we're hungry. We have desire if we're hoping to get home in time to get to an important Zoom meeting. Or I had the desire to drive to Redwood City this morning at some level. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have gotten here. And sometimes desire comes in the form of not wanting something, right? Maybe we want the neighbor's dog to stop barking. Or also this morning while I was driving here, there was a squirrel crossing the lane in front of me. There were no other cars coming. But halfway across the road, it changed its mind and came back. And so I slowed way down. It wasn't clear which way it was going to go. And I felt my mind narrowing, which it does through desire. But I didn't want to hurt the squirrel. I had a strong desire not to hit the squirrel with my car. And luckily it headed back into the grass. So, you know, there's a lot of desires. And then there can be more subtle desires, like while we're sitting. Often it's hard to sit in the same position for a long time. We actually will subtly shift our weight, even when we're meditating sometimes, but also on the computer. And that's just because, you know, there's a desire to move or shift. The body isn't meant to be in the same position for a long time. Or we can sit in meditation and subtly be holding on to a state of calm, for example. We want that to continue now that we've got it. So there's a lot. So let me ask a question then. How many of you would agree if I say that the second noble truth of the cause of suffering says that the cause of suffering is desire? Yeah, and that's often what we hear. I see some hands, not all the hands. So, you know, there's a lot of wanting in the mind, and what's going on with that? And so another proposal that can also be checked is that at some level, we tend to think that fulfilling our desires is going to bring happiness, or at least it's going to make things better than it is now. So we fulfill desire after desire to try to get things that we like or get things that feel pleasant so that we can sustain a sense of some kind of happiness or ease or safety or well-being, whatever word we use for it. So it's actually not such a ridiculous idea to want those things in our life, but it may not be complete, you know, to have the idea that we need to keep wanting things and getting them in order to be safe or happy or have well-being. And if we practice mindfulness, we will start to see more of the picture. So if we keep looking with mindfulness, there's a couple things we might see. There's a lot of things we might see, but I'll just highlight a couple of them. One of them is that it is not entirely the case that we can become happy by fulfilling desires. How many would agree with that? Yeah, so nearly all the hands went up for that one. So, you know, it's tiring to constantly be going from thing to thing to thing, and we have to keep at it, right? Because each one lasts for a while, but not forever. So there's always, and then there's always one more thing coming, one more refinement, one more next thing that we want. And all of this is not entirely in our control, is it? You know, at some level, we understand that the things that we want we don't have complete ability to get. Some things it's easy, sort of. It's pretty likely you can take your next breath, but not always, right? But that's pretty likely. That one's pretty likely. But other things that we try to get, that we have to buy or that we have to go and acquire or get from somebody else, there's a whole other set of conditions out there that are not in our control about whether we can get that, right, if we start looking more clearly. So we may not be able to get what we want or get rid of what we don't want. How about that? What does the mind do with that? So our quest to find happiness by fulfilling desires gets more and more suspect as we practice mindfulness. And then maybe the second thing that we would realize is that not all desires are actually harmful for us. Not completely. I deliberately painted a little bit of a complex picture at the beginning with all the things that I pointed toward. So some desires might be useful on the spiritual path, maybe, right? And some of the very real happiness that we get from fulfilling desires, because there is a kind of happiness we get from that, some of that might be good for us. You know, how about the peace that you get from coming to IMC or watching on YouTube? You know, that seems useful, doesn't it? Settle the heart and mind better than doing something else with this hour, hour and a half. So we're going to have to look more carefully at these issues of desire and wanting. So I'll just say clearly, so it's stated, are all desires bad? No. No. But we have to have a lot of wisdom about that. So, you know, the Buddha was actually quite nuanced in his teachings on desire. He taught in different ways at different times. He taught different people differently, knowing where they were on the spiritual path. But basically he noticed, I think he was brilliant, that he noticed that there is in the mind a tendency to move toward things, also a tendency to move away, which is related. You know, we're here and we want to move toward there. Let's broadly call that desire. And so he thought, well, you know, people have this tendency of wanting to move toward and away, which is to some degree a quality of the unawakened mind, but we have it, so why not use it? Why not use it on the path to move toward things that are actually helpful? So I want to talk about this desire that we have, this movement toward. And I like to say that there's a broad range of desire or a diversity of desire, kind of like a spectrum of desire, but it's not really linear. It's not really a linear sequence. It's more like a space. So I'm going to frame it today as five aspects of desire or five classes of desire. This is not a canonical list from the Buddha, but all of them are talked about in the teachings, and I've just kind of gathered them together. You can see if it's, I hope it's a useful way of classifying things. So as we get in touch with these, I'm going to talk about each one. You might just sense for yourself, oh, okay, is that present in me? How does that operate in my life? How does that resonate for me? So the first kind of desire, clearly in the unwholesome part of the space, is the one that's called a tanha. That's the Pali word, tanha. And it literally means thirst, but it's usually translated as craving. This is a kind of grasping kind of desire that is obviously painful, obviously harmful. You know, it's a gripping, essentially. It relates to lust or greed or kind of extreme wanting that we have. And, you know, we've all experienced this, actually. And when this kind of craving is about the world of the senses, which it often is, we call it kama tanha, which means it's desire for sensual things, sense desire or sense pleasure, like the Kama Sutra you may have heard of, very much about sensuality. And so Kama Tanha is strong grasping of sensual objects. It's not really about the object itself. It's in the mind, you know, so we might have strong grasping at ice cream at a certain time and not at another time. right? It's not about the ice cream. It's about how much we want it at a given time. Or we might be caught up in how we look, you know, our clothing, our hairdo, or various sexual fantasies and desires. A particular form of this kind of desire is addiction to alcohol or drugs. So tanha generally causes trouble for us, and it's clearly a troublesome one. It can also relate to things that aren't sensual. I emphasized that one, but there are other things. We can have lust for power or for having a certain identity, being seen in a certain way. That can also be the realm of tanha. So it's obvious that these kind of desires don't support the path to liberation, right? They are themselves binding for the mind. And then maybe a second class of desire is basic desires that are related to bodily needs. We all have these, to need to eat, the need to drink, the need to use the bathroom. So these desires are not usually seen as inherently harmful, but they are somewhat stressful, aren't they? How we relate to the desires and needs of the body influences how happy or unhappy we are. Even awakened people still feel physical hunger, and they still have the need to pee. That still happens. There's one sutta that says that even arahants, who are fully awakened beings, feel sensations that are, according to the sutta, dependent on the body and conditioned by life. So there you go. You're not going to overcome those basic things. Even the Buddha had back pain. You know, they're not all pleasant, these things related to the body. But there is some distinction between beings regarding whether or not these bodily desires bring any dukkha, any suffering. Then there's a third class of desire, very big one, that's related to the desires that it takes to fulfill a human life. You know, trying to live a typical human life among other humans, we have desires that go with that. The desire to find a livelihood, maybe the desire to have a partner, the desire to be part of a community, to secure a place to live and have access to food that we like. All of these desires, this is the world many of us live in from day to day. These desires take a lot of energy, a lot of our attention and effort. And they're myriad. I can't even name them all. I just named a few. Relationships, politics, family life, all these worldly desires. Gill sometimes says that we should call ourselves, instead of human beings, we should be called human desirelings, which I think is, that's always struck me. I've heard that from him years and years ago, and it stuck with me. So these kinds of desires are very interesting for the spiritual path, because they're the ones that we tend to defend as normal and even necessary. You know, if I didn't have those desires, what would I do? I'd just sit on the couch all day. I'd be a couch potato. I wouldn't do anything. I couldn't accomplish things. I couldn't help people. I couldn't serve my family. So we tend to mark these desires off as off limits. This is necessary. We don't even, you know, how can we even question those? The Buddha asked us to put a few question marks on those, as to whether or not we have to pursue them with any kind of grasping. So it's a big realm for Dharma practice, because this realm of desires occupies much of our day. These are the ones that we go from one to one to one throughout our day, right? So many of them are mild forms of what I called kama before, the world of sense desires and sensual pleasures. Not all of them are tanha, that grasping kind of desire, but they're kama, this world of the senses. And we don't have to have deep pathological grasping in order to be somewhat enslaved to our desires. And the Buddha asked us to question that enslavement and see if we could find other ways to live our life such that it doesn't have that inherent stress associated with all those things. So then, continuing with the five classes of desire, with a fourth one, I would call our more elevated human wishes. There are various words for this: wholesome, skillful, refined, elevated, spiritual. Choose the word that works for you. But these include wishing to be ethical, wishing to be kind, wanting a peaceful and happy life where we are able to care more about how we're living than about money or status, wanting to learn to meditate, wanting to learn the spiritual teachings, desire for the well-being of others. These are nice desires. These are generally very good desires. These are the kind of wishes that can serve our spiritual development if we engage with them, right? So these are the ones where the Buddha used our, let's call them elevated desires, as part of the path. He encouraged us to do these kinds of skillful wishes in order to uplift us or draw us along the path. So when we allow these wishes to be felt in our heart, they encourage us towards skillful and wholesome action. And the happiness that comes from fulfilling these kinds of desires, this fourth class, are nourishing. They bring a nourishing kind of happiness to us. So these are the wishes that can support confidence, ease, brightness, a certain kind of refined joy. Not a bubbly kind of joy, more associated with the sense world, but a tranquil kind of joy. And that's the kind of pleasure that the Buddha approved of. This is actually repeated in several suttas. This is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and that it should not be feared. How about that? The Buddha says there are kinds of pleasure that should be pursued. So there's also, you know, the famous story of the Buddha realizing that all of the efforts he had done up to now, this is the Bodhisattva before he was the Buddha, realizing that everything he'd done hadn't brought awakening yet. And he was frustrated. All of his ascetic practices, all of his practices of the formless jhanas. And then he thought back to a time in his childhood where he entered meditative absorption as a child sitting under a tree peacefully, and how easeful and joyful that felt. And he recognized that that was the way forward, that was the path, this kind of meditative pleasure that he had first felt somewhat spontaneously. He then cultivated that under the Bodhi tree and was able to awaken. So these kinds of pleasures and happinesses are part of the path. It's important to note that even though that quote I read included the bliss of enlightenment, these are not the goal, actually. So this kind of meditative pleasure that we get, that comes kind of as a fruit or a byproduct of calming the mind and calming the body and having bright awareness, that is not actually freedom yet. There can still be some delusion in there, such as a sense of self or pride. But if we keep up with the mindfulness practice, that will be, those kind of side points will be seen and addressed at some point. And this happiness, this meditative happiness, will allow us to awaken. So that's the fifth class of desire, which I think is worth separating out, is specifically the aspiration to awaken, to be free, to be liberated. That can take various forms. You know, what kind of wanting is that? So it's wanting to know, to discover, to investigate, to see, to touch into, to realize, to release these kinds of wishes. Often these desires and aspirations feel very beautiful, very clean, very wholesome, a little bit distinct from that fourth class where we want to be ethical, we want to be kind, etc. Sometimes, at certain points on the path, this fifth kind of desire to awaken can get very strong. And then it's called samvega, or samvega, which is often translated as spiritual urgency. And maybe you felt that one also. For some people, there's a resonance with the Western idea of a calling to practice, a deep sense of wishing to be free. Sometimes it can be a little bit unpleasant even. So these desires feel beautiful and clean and wholesome, and then there can also be, ah, get me out. And that's part of the process too sometimes. This wishing to be free can come really straight from the heart. So we have these five. We have tanha, grasping kind of desire. We have basic desires related to fulfilling bodily needs. We have the desires that accompany living a human life among other humans. We have our more spiritual wishes for kindness, for ethics, for meditative development. And then we specifically have the aspiration to be liberated. So they're not quite a linear spectrum. I hope you see they kind of define a space. But nonetheless, there is a clear division between unwholesome and wholesome, right? Between unskillful and skillful. Some of them are blatantly painful, you know, and those are the ones that we can feel, that contraction. Other ones, we tend to make a trade-off. You know, we say, I want this, and the benefits of it are going to be better than the detriment, so I'm going for it. You know, like when we're working a certain job that has some stress associated with it, but we need the income. So we make these trade-offs in the kind of the middle realm. And then, you know, there's some of them that are really quite beautiful, and we can fulfill those as much as we want, clearly helpful, and that will support us on our path. So I want to delve now a little bit into that realm that I called the skillful desire, because it's not talked about as much as in that way. So I hope you're seeing at this point that, you know, there's a lot of different kinds, and we're going to need to be careful about, you know, which side we're on. We'll talk about that. So what about these skillful desires, these wishes that can support the path? So in that scheme of five, they were the fourth and the fifth. But actually, I'm going to take a step back into that third realm and say that it's important to realize that in order to support our more elevated, spiritual, refined kind of desires, we have to do some work in the realm of the third kind of desire, the everyday wants and needs of creating a human life. We have to do some preparatory work in the realm of our life in order to bolster our ability to fully develop these more refined kinds of desire. So in other words, we have to set ourselves up. We have to set up our life. Everybody in this room and on YouTube, you have set up yourself such that you could be here this morning. That's not bad. That's already an accomplishment. A lot of people haven't done that. So we can work in the very ordinary realm of the sensual world, the stuff of our life, in order to create conditions that we'll be able to move forward on the path with the more refined kinds of happiness. So there's a couple things I want to say about that. First of all, we need to simplify. We need to simplify our life in certain ways in order to support practice. So this is aligning with our lifestyle with that. And I want to read some lines actually from the Metta Sutta, from the sutta, the Buddha's discourse on metta, on loving kindness or goodwill, that are they're right at the beginning, and they point toward a way of being that has an air of simplicity to it that I find quite touching. A way of being that's kind of straightforward and uncomplicated. So this is from the Amaravati translation of that sutta. Some of you may recognize it because it's done in a chant. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Doesn't it feel nice just to hear that? People who are like that are really nice to be around. And this has to do with generating the conditions for loving kindness in our life. But it points toward a simplification of how we are, simplifying our actions, simplifying our speech to be straightforward and gentle, probably even simplifying our thought processes so that we're not always caught up in a million theories and speculations and anxieties about what other people are thinking about us. Not necessary and not so supportive of our practice. So we want to live in a way that has some spaciousness to it, to the degree that we can. That can be, I support creating some outer spaciousness if we can, reducing the amount of running around that we do, simplifying our activities, bringing in more spiritual friends into our life. But even if you know, those aren't your life conditions, you have busyness, you have many people, you have work that's complex, there can be an inner spaciousness in relating to that. You know, this phrase, unburdened with duties. There's a lot to be said for not having too many duties. And if you do, there's a way of being unburdened by them, right? There's a way of relating to them such that they aren't heavy and difficult and stressful for us if we create inner spaciousness around those. So if we want a life of practice that includes a life of metta and goodwill and kindness, these words that I offered give us some touchstones: straightforwardness, gentleness, humble, contented, unburdened, frugal. And so then that leads into finding ways to relate to the sensory world, the material world, skillfully, so that we can create a sense of refuge, you know, of all the vast realm of skillful and desires and wishes. I'm talking about just one here, but the desires that help us find refuge. And some of those actually come from the sensory world, from the material world. So the five physical senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, can be used or related to in ways that nourish our heart and mind. These are often associated, of course, the sense realm in Buddhist teachings is often associated with the need for restraint. That's the word used. And I would agree with that generally, because often we're not restrained in that realm, and that only leads to stress and so forth. But not all sense stimuli are to be avoided. How can we? We have these sense organs, so we don't have to avoid everything. We can use the sense world in ways that evoke faith, that evoke refuge, that evoke nourishment for us when we're properly attuned. We can even use the sixth sense, which is our cognition, our mind, in ways that are nourishing. Sometimes people have the idea about spiritual practice that anything related to thinking is bad. Anything related to, you know, cognizing is very suspect. It should all just be kind of, I don't know, coming from the heart, coming from emotions. But it's not the case. We can use our thinking mind. We can use the fullness of our mind and heart to nourish us. So I want to name a number of ways that we can use the ordinary stuff of our life, our six senses, as to encourage refuge and a sense of faith and ability to go forward with our practice, to align our life with Dharma practice. I guess I'll say them somewhat quickly, not with a lot of elaboration, with the idea that you might just kind of feel which ones resonate for you. And maybe you'll also get some new ideas. If you let me name a lot of them, you'll get some new ideas and say, oh, you know, I'm not really using that realm, using that form in a way that could be helpful for me. So for some, seeing certain objects such as, you know, the Buddha Rupa, for example, or images, even monastic robes, going to see monastics, can be deeply nourishing. That's interesting. There's a way in which our visual senses can resonate with something in us. The posture that the Buddha is in when sitting in these Buddha rupas, I don't know if you can see from where you are, but there's kind of an elevation of his chest. And this is actually deliberate. It's meant to evoke a sense of confidence. That posture has an uprightness to it. You remember that word from what I just read in the Metta Sutta? And there's a way in which we can, you know, we're not going to necessarily literally imitate what a stone figure is doing, but there is a way that if we sit up straight or feel the mirror between us and this rupa, there's a way that we can actually feel some of that confidence in ourself. The posture of the body is not irrelevant in how we feel. So there's that, and then there's the beauty of a retreat center. It's not an accident that the aesthetic in this room is simple. There's this meant to evoke simplicity so that we have simplicity in the mind also. That doesn't mean our mind is simple when it comes here, but we can be inspired by that. It can be uplifting. There's a subtle sense of calm. And it might also be that you can feel, if you have a certain sensibility when you walk into a room like this, can you feel the stillness in this room? Because a lot of people have meditated in here. There's been a lot of hours of meditation in here. And so there's a way in which that, I mean, that's a sense coming in through our sense doors, and yet it can be nourishing for us if we open to it. Hearing the Dharma has long served as a gateway to profound insight, and at a more ordinary level, it's inspirational. So, you know, being here this morning to hear the Dharma, and there's also, you know, a vast number of talks and guided meditations available online and in other forms. So listening can be a ready source of support for our practice. Is that a sense desire to want to hear the Dharma? Yeah, but it also goes in that elevated realm. Reading the Dharma is also good. You know, reading, using the mind, using the cognition. I recommend reading the original texts if you're drawn to them. Of course, in English translation, there are good English translations available now. And there are also some very good modern interpretations by teachers, Dharma books of various kinds. The Buddha encourages reflection on the teachings. You are allowed to think about what you've read. Think about whether it makes sense to you. Think about how it might apply in your life. Have questions about whether it's really the case, what that really means. You probably wouldn't want to do a lot of long thinking while you're sitting in meditation, just because we want to separate those. But, you know, outside of sitting on the cushion, please do think about the Dharma, reflect on it. For some practitioners, the first taste of kind of real confidence in the Dharma comes when we read something that is exactly like what we've experienced. You know, we've been sitting for maybe even just a short time, but we've experienced something, or we've felt something, or our mind shifts in a certain way. And then we pick up a sutta or a teacher quotes something in a talk, and we realize, oh, the Buddha said exactly what I've experienced. And that was 2,600 years ago. Huh, maybe this guy did know something about how the mind works. So I'm joking a little bit, but there's really can be a profound resonance when we see that at least some of what's in the suttas reflects what we see in our own mind and body right here in the modern world. And we also understand, oh, the mind can be trained. The process works. Even when I meditate, it's not an exception. I'm not the exception. Oh, it works for everyone else, but not going to work for me. But it does, when we see that it does. So that can be very nourishing. And I think it also helps at a more emotional level. It's really nice if we hear stories about people who overcame their suffering. You know, in the suttas, there's a wonderful story about a woman named Kisa Gotami, who was very distraught because her baby died, and she carried the child around. She just couldn't grok the death, and brought even, you know, and everybody was like, you know, not able to help her really. And she came to the Buddha with her dead child, and he said, "Okay, you know, there's help for you if you can get a mustard seed from a house where no one has died." So she set off on this quest. Brilliantly skillful teaching on the Buddha's part, because house after house after house was willing to give her a mustard seed. It's a tiny little thing, but there wasn't any house where nobody had died. So she got it. You know, she got it over time. And we can be inspired by these more subtle ways that the Buddha taught people. He didn't always just talk about the five kinds of desire. but there were, you know, he really could touch into people's deepest emotions and find ways to connect that into the Dharma. So, you know, we can learn from this also. We can resonate with her grief and also with her wisdom and understanding through that practice. The Buddha's compassion. And then also being in nature. That's a decidedly sensory experience. But being in nature can give us a glimpse of the Dharma in certain ways that sometimes can penetrate more deeply than things that are explicitly spiritual sometimes. You know, just seeing the trees, the bees, the clouds, the streams. Did you guys see the blooming dogwood on the way in? Amazing. So, you know, these things tell us about impermanence, impersonality, conditionality. In a very straightforward way, we see the cycle of life happening and we understand how we're part of it. This too is the Dharma. And the truth of nature can heal and clarify things for us. And then there are certain devotional actions. This isn't for everyone, but if you've never tried it, you might. Certain devotional actions that can uplift our heart and mind. That maybe make it more easy for us to connect in with these refined forms of happiness. So for some people, bowing, you know, maybe before you start meditation, or chanting or ritual, these things can connect us in with the spiritual dimension of life. I guess there's a fortunate resonance in that this afternoon at IMC there's going to be a session on chanting and talking about some of the devotional practices of Asia with a wonderful scholar. And that's his profession, is to be a Buddhist scholar, but I would say he's really quite a deep practitioner who has studied this. So if you're at all interested, 1 to 3 o'clock this afternoon, there will be, and I think it's online also. I think it's a hybrid. So even for those of you on YouTube, it's possible. So that's not everyone's cup of tea, but for some skeptics, like me originally, some skeptics have been stunned at how deeply these kinds of simple devotional actions can go. They can really touch the heart. So, are there ways that you could express your spiritual desires through your material life? It's a question for all of you just to consider. You know, is there some way that you could shift, maybe take some of the energy that's going into ordinary desires like food, comfort, various pleasures? I mean, we devote a lot of our attention to that. How am I going to get this or that or that? Get the next one that's going to be good. How could we convert that into elevated desires for simple surroundings that support practice, for trust and confidence in practice, for learning the teachings, for spiritual community? There's a way in which we can elevate our wishes along the, you know, toward the upper end of those five classes of desire. And sometimes we're able to literally kind of convert the ones that are a little bit more worldly focused. Oh, it would be even more nourishing if I could want these deeper things, these things that are part of the path. So we started by talking about how desire, first of all, is very prominent for us, but also that it has some subtlety to it. Clearly, a lot of the desires that we chase don't really help us. They're exhausting. We don't have control over them. They're pretty temporary when we get them. They don't last, then we have to do the next one. And yet, some things are good to want. I don't know if you can get awakened without wanting that at some level. It's not going to just happen. So we have to do something. We have to want something along the way. So, so these spiritual wishes for goodness and meditative development are good ways to direct that movement toward in our mind, movement toward to be movement along the path. Eventually, I think we will move into the complete release of maybe all kinds of desire except for those bodily ones, but definitely we move into the release of tanha, the grasping part of desire. That is the cause of suffering in the Second Noble Truth. It's not desire, it's tanha. It's the grasping kind of desire. But then that leads to a natural question, how do we know? How do I know if I want something? Is that a good want or an unhelpful want? It's a little bit of a trial and error. There's a need for discernment there. We have to keep checking. We can check. Are wholesome states in the mind increasing and unwholesome states decreasing? Or the reverse? If we want kindness, we will tend to not increase our tanha when we do that. If we want to be kind, it can still creep in. We can want to be kind, and then we can say, ha, I'm really a kind person. we take it on as an identity, and that's when it becomes unskillful, slips into that. But if we just keep checking, is there wholesomeness? Is what I'm wanting helping me to become more wholesome, more skillful? That's probably a good kind of desire. And also we can check if we're more, felt sense meditator, we can check if there's tension associated with a certain desire. If we want something that's, grasping or, more in the sensory realm, it tends to bring some tension, some stress with it, whereas other kinds of wants have a more open feeling to them. There's still a little bit of tension maybe, but it's more subtle. And we can also check whether what we're wanting will help others or only us. That's a good clue. If it would help others, then it's more in the realm of skillful. So developing this kind of discernment is part of the path also. We are not perfect at first at knowing whether we're having skillful, unskillful desire. So we'll have to develop that over time. But one implication of thinking in this way is that the whole world becomes our realm of practice. Every moment, every encounter, every wish that we have in our mind, right here in the tangible world, is a doorway to taking a step on the path, if we can see it in that way. So there's a completeness, there's a fullness to our relationship to life. And especially when we've undertaken a spiritual path, then we start to see the ways in which some of what we do supports that and some of what we do doesn't support that. And we can start to prioritize, move toward this movement toward, move toward the things that are actually helping us, that are then propelling us along the path. And part of the subtlety of this knowing about which desires are helpful and not is that it shifts over time. So something that was helpful for a while might become unhelpful later. And we have to let go of certain desires that were okay at the beginning, but then they become burdensome. So be prepared for those shifts over time. So I hope what this has done is maybe clarified a little bit this realm of desire so that we don't have an automatic sense of, oh, it's all bad. I've got to get rid of all my desires. And then the reaction against that, but I don't want to get rid of all my desires and I shouldn't have to and blah, blah, blah. We can sweep all of that aside and consider instead this dimension of wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful, which desires are supporting the path and moving more and more toward having more of those in our life. And then letting the mindfulness take care of the rest of it, letting the ones fall away, moving us toward, that aren't helpful, moving us toward that final movement into freedom, into awakening, freedom from all those movements of mind. So thank you. I guess we would have time for one. We're pretty much at the end, so I'll stay a little longer if anybody would like to come up and ask anything, but thank you.